Let's get started. There are four handouts, although the fourth one is the synopsis assignment for this week, for those who didn't get it at the last class. We have free copying for a couple weeks because they're trying to sell us a new copy machine on the lower floor of Furno. So as I see things of interest, I make copies. The piece from the Wall Street Journal on animal cognition was just in the other day, and I thought that was especially interesting. And the piece also on the Blair Amendment. And then the piece from Solzhenitsyn I thought was a very interesting short passage as well. I'm sort of practicing up for retirement, and I've been, as busy as I've been this fall, I've been reading some novels because that's one of the things I hope to do in retirement. How many of you have ever read Solzhenitsyn? Two. You know, it really ties in very closely with a few words I want to say at the beginning of the class today. As I was pondering on what to say in the last two classes, it dawned on me that one of the great, great, great tragedies of higher education today in America and perhaps increasingly in other parts of the world is that it has become almost entirely a matter of knowledge transfer and learning certain skills. And what traditionally we would think of as human wisdom is not that much a part of the curriculum anymore. It was the case when I came to Cornell 30 years ago that in the Ag College you did not have to take a single humanities course. Now I think you have to take only two. But 30 years ago you didn't have to take a single course. And as I've been reading Solzhenitsyn's novel, The First Circle, which talks about life in the Soviet prison camps, in fact, in one particular kind of camp. The reference is to Dante's First Circle in Hell. The particular camp that the First Circle describes is where they had engineers and mathematicians and scientists who were required to do 12 hours a day work 7 days a week because they were used to develop weapons and other things that were needed by the economy. But one of the remarkable things about reading The First Circle, I'm finding, is the incredible discussions that Solzhenitsyn imagines and to some extent reports, because he himself was a prisoner in a couple of the different gulags and so on, is the way in which they talk again and again about the meaning of human life and human existence. Here are people who have an extremely restricted life, who yet feel that very, very deep human need to talk about what life is about, the meaning of life, the meaning of love, of relationship, and so on. And as I've been reading this, I've had a profound sense of sadness about education today, because so much of education today, as I've said, is simply knowledge transfer. It's simply preparing you to be savvy consumers and savvy producers. One of our former deans in agriculture referred to the college as a knowledge production. I think he used the term facility. I shuddered when I heard that term. And I say that without disrespect to science and technology and engineering. All of these make life considerably better for us in many ways. But the incredible lack of opportunity in much of higher education today to think about what most human beings through the ages have called wisdom. To talk about what life is about, how we want to live, what it means. And this is very closely related to the way we've approached ethics in this course. I am very grateful for the insights that philosophical ethics has given us, the insights that the Kantians and the utilitarians and others have given us. And yet, I have become more and more convinced over the years that by far the greater part of ethics is learning what it means to be a human being. And if I had my way, I think I'd teach the course in two semesters, and perhaps a whole semester would be reading some of the great literature that we have available to us that really discusses the kinds of dilemmas that people lead in actual life. One is one of the dilemmas that the prisoners faced was, what does it mean really to love someone? If you had a 25-year term in prison for what was seen as sedition or somehow hampering the progress of the proletariat, and you had been married, say, at 25, what do you do? Do you encourage your wife to leave you? Because what kind of a life is that, to wait 25 years with the possibility that if you don't perform well, that you'll get another 10 years or so? What do you do in cases like that? These are profoundly difficult human issues. And I think it is tragic in a way that with the easiness of television and modern media, that in some ways, some of the great novels and some of the great literature of the ages is simply not being read. 35 years ago, I gave a seminar on prison literature that emanated from World War II, from the Japanese prison camps, from the Russian gulags, from the Nazi death camps. And it was a profoundly human experience to see people under the most incredible circumstances fighting to preserve their humanity. Learning, for instance, that in the camps where they expended the energy to put on plays and poetic readings and things like this, they survived at a much higher level than in camps where they were totally utilitarian and focused only on their survival. But as I've been thinking about this, it really is a sadness to me. And I hope, as our new president, Jeff Lehman, has asked for feedback on the university, I do hope some of you will give that feedback and ask questions about what really is a good education today. Is it just to learn to be a better producer and consumer? Is it just knowledge transfer? Or is it something that has more immediately to do with who we are as human beings, what nature is like, what animals are like? This little piece here from the Wall Street Journal on animal cognition I found incredibly interesting. I don't know if the author or the research is correct, but it suggests that there's an awfully lot we don't know about animals. And it's possible that dolphins, for instance, may know when they don't know. That would be a very, very interesting result. In some of the tests where you're supposed to go this way or this way, and then when the range is too small, they seem to register a response, I don't know, I can't figure it out. Are they somehow consciously aware of this? But there are such profoundly interesting human questions. And as I've said, it's part of the sadness that I face that it seems to me that education has moved away from these. This was not always so. Throughout almost all of human history, certainly as long as there have been universities, education was seen primarily in terms of moral, spiritual, human development, character development, developing in our sense of ethics, morality, what it means to be a human being. This was true of almost all of our early universities in America. And it's only really within the last 130 years or so, partly under the influence of the great graduate schools in Germany and in Europe, that we shifted to a much more technical understanding of education. And I guess as I look back over a lifetime of teaching, there is a certain sadness about that. Where I taught for the first 13 years at Earlham College, a small Quaker liberal arts college in Indiana, we truly did raise more of these kinds of human questions. Whether they still do that today, I'm not sure. But it was a wonderful experience when people talked across disciplines, met frequently, and wrestled with some of these deep human issues. What I decided I'd like to do today is something I've never tried before in the class. I've done a lot of talking this fall. I'd like to hear a few comments from you. Take about 2 or 3 minutes and write down either a question you have that's raised by the material in the course or a comment you'd like to make. I'd like to hear a little bit about where you are in your thinking about some of these issues. I will feel that we've done a good job this fall if you leave with lots of questions, perhaps a few hints of where the answers to some of these questions lie. But I'd like to really, in a way, get a sounding or a reading about where you're at. What are a few questions that you think are outstanding that we would still need to deal with if we had another semester? Comments that you'd like to make about what we might have studied or what some of the things you've learned. Just take about 2 or 3 minutes and jot down a thought or two, and then I'm just going to ask you to share some of this. Okay. I'd like particularly, if some of you haven't said much during the semester or asked many questions, I'm a little scared when I try this sort of thing. You never know whether anyone's going to respond or not. But let's just talk a little with each other. What kinds of questions or thoughts or ideas come to mind that have been stimulated by the readings or the discussions and so on? Questions, comments? I think it'd be nice to get a sense of this. That moment of silence. Eric, what are you thinking? Okay, you don't. Okay. Some of you are writing papers on this. It's a very important question for a pluralist society. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just sort of thinking along the same lines. Just we talked a little bit about pluralism and ethics, but in terms of pluralism and religion, when we talked about the ideas of faith and knowledge, and faith being sort of a different kind of knowing, but that's legitimate, and if you see sort of mankind's role in a certain framework, you can avoid imposing it, coercively on other people, but you're still imposing your beliefs about their way of life, and that it's not as necessarily as yours because you believe in a certain system.
Okay, say a little more about that. What do you mean imposing your way of life?
I mean, even if you're not imposing your way of life, you're still, at least in your own head, maybe imposing a sense of judgment that the framework by which others live their life isn't necessarily, the true framework.
Now, do you think we all do this, whether we're religious or not?
To some extent, probably. I mean, ethical judgments.
Okay, this, I think, is clearly one of the questions we've wrestled with. Can you have a civilized society? Can you have a flourishing society? Can you take good care of the environment, for instance, if you're not willing to impose certain beliefs and values on other people? That's a very fundamental political question. It's one of the questions that the characters, the prisoners in the First Circle, are constantly discussing, because their experience, of course, is the experience under Stalin, where Stalin was so paranoid about all of his enemies that it wasn't just imposition, it was a reign of terror. And that was imposition with a vengeance, including the annihilation and imprisonment of people who got in the way. But can we have a flourishing civilized society without, in some cases, imposing our beliefs and values, whether secular or religious, whatever, on other people?
There's also within religions in terms of unity and disunity between sort of different factions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is one of the questions I trust that you'll continue to wrestle with. It's a very fundamental human question. How much freedom can you allow, and where do you have to draw some lines? And it's absolutely basic to environmental ethics. When do you tell people you simply cannot do certain things that are polluting and potentially hurtful to other people? Okay? Other thoughts? Carl, nice to see you. Carl Johnson in the back directs Cornell Team Building Outdoor Education Program, and he was a TA in this course for quite a few years. Yeah. What are you thinking? Colleen?
I I guess, like, the biggest question I have with the more environmental stuff from the beginning and even the stuff from the end of the semester is kind of where do we go from here in terms of applying this to the other things we do at the university?
Okay. Do you have some thoughts on that?
No.
Can anyone help Colleen out? How do you tie in some of these ideas with other things we're doing at the university? Greg, you looked like you wanted to say something.
I have a similar question that some of the work we go from here. I'm thinking even more generally about the basic point of this course. One of the basic points of this course is that we live in a culture that at some level has kind of put religion out of the picture in dealing with public issues and doing politics. So here's this question of, well, how do we, the first question, how would we bring religion into the political sphere? How do you do that responsibly if that's what's lacking?
Okay.
And you know, we sort of suggested that it's sort of odd that the Jews want to ignore the religious spectrum, especially when it's been so influential in this country. So issues of slavery, issues of civil rights, which, you know, are not issues, that issue may not be finished, but we look at religion as having actually been a perpetuator of those things, as a reason why we still have slavery, or as a reason why we segregated, we can justify those through religious grounds, and so we don't trust the religion entirely. But then, without religious movements, we wouldn't have changed those things the way we did, and they wouldn't have the kind of permanence that they have. So we suggest the same thing, perhaps, with the environment, that here we are trying to look at the fact that there are religious ramifications, that there are things that need to be said from a religious perspective, and maybe without those perspectives, we don't have the moxie or the sustainability in our movements to bring about change. But if that's the case, if that's what we're suggesting for environmental concerns and issues of ethics, looking around at the stage of the movement, trying to compare where are we compared to where slavery was, or where are we compared to where civil rights were. We haven't had our Emancipation Proclamation for, you know, limitation on over-exploitation of natural resources. We haven't had the March on Washington where some visionary figure gives a speech and says, I have a dream of sustainable resource use, and boom, you know, you know, galvanizes the nation. We haven't had that. I guess my question of where we go from here, how do we see that? What is, where are we with that? And how would we continue to move towards a kind of a place where a dialogue between the environmental movement and secular environmental thought can engage enough with religious communities where we do have that more of a given thing?
Let me try to broaden that a little, Greg. See if you feel comfortable with this. I would argue that in one sense it is not just religion, it is metaphysics and philosophy and ideas about the good life. We've talked just a little bit that in classical liberalism the state guarantees justice, the state keeps you from harming each other, keeps us from harming each other, but the state does not tell us anything about the nature of the good life. Whereas it looks as if some of the environmental issues like wilderness preservation and intergenerational responsibility and our treatment of animals have to do with the good life as well as with procedural justice. So in a way, I wonder, Greg, if the issue is not even broader. It does focus partly on religion. But in another sense, if you look at where a lot of the philosophers are and a lot of the political theorists, they don't want to talk about the good life. They just want to talk about procedural justice. So maybe the issue is even bigger, that we have privatized all discussion of the nature of the good life. This is simply to be chosen by individuals. The state is not to tell us what the good life is about, but the problem is that there doesn't seem to be any easy way then to implement environmental concerns, because many of them seem to have to do with the good life as well as with harming each other. Would that be a legitimate extension, do you think, of your idea there?
I guess that's part of it. I mean, so maybe that stands as a barrier again.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that? That's an important social issue that we face. is it a good thing that we have so largely privatized discussions about the good life? This is not historically a common thing. Most societies have had much more public discussions, and today there's almost a sense that it's not just privatized, but you're doing something illegitimate when you try to raise some of these kinds of concerns in public. And any other thoughts on that? Carl, do you have anything to add to that? Okay. Gary?
I'm not sure I agree entirely with all of them. There is certainly a huge problem that comes up because of this direction in our society. And, I don't want to get into a discussion of exactly what I mean by being politically correct. By that, there are certain things we don't discuss and certain arguments we avoid in public.
Okay. Okay.
And particularly in academia, we're very careful to be politically correct in that way.
Okay.
So what that means, what I'm concerned about, is that the general public and decision makers, the academics, the people really thinking about these things, come across with a great deal of insincerity, of lack of integrity.
Okay.
Because everybody knows we've got a private, interior conversation. We do have values.
Okay.
And we're just... How are we going to be believed and taken seriously when we're not communicating everything that we think?
Okay, a nice example of that would, just one sec, a nice example of that would be the, and I did that deliberately, the lecture I gave on fatherlessness. It is simply not politically correct in most university settings, in cases where they deal with human development and so on, and social pathologies, to talk much about fatherlessness. The politically correct thing is to talk about poverty and bad schools and so on, but not family breakdown. Is this a problem we face in the universities? I think in some ways a very serious problem. Not that I'm 100% convinced that my particular views on this are correct, but that I'm convinced that the issue ought to be out in the open and we ought to be able to discuss it. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
It's done what?
It's fueled the egoist movement.
Okay.
And there's this, people are just convinced that because the self is just forced to look at all these things by itself, that somehow the self is somehow greater than everything else around it. And I really feel that people were to step back and realize that they need the help of others and they need the help of something else, that a lot of these problems would sort of dissolve on their own.
Incredibly well said. This is exactly Iris Murdoch's point. That when you become totally preoccupied just with getting exactly the right ethical answer here or here, when you get totally preoccupied with what she calls the machinery of your own psyche, you become more and more self-absorbed and less able really to reach out with love and care and justice towards other people. So in some ways, this privatization, each of us becomes the quintessential consumer, not just of material goods, but now the quintessential consumer and creator of values. Even the Supreme Court makes a big point. Each of us has the right to decide on and design and so on our lifestyle, our worldview, which in one sense I understand, but in another sense seems almost as silly to me as saying each of us has a right to decide on our individual system of chemistry and physics and math. But well said, well said. There was another hand. Yes, Tamara?
Well, I was just...
Nice and loud so everyone can hear.
I was just noticing with the talk about private life and the state that, you know, there's sort of two definitions of private, and one is just not governmental or not with the state, and the other one is individual or sort of hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just because the state doesn't tell us about how to live a good life doesn't mean that we shouldn't discuss that in public.
Okay.
I really would like to see myself more public life that is not taken care of by the government.
Okay, this is also incredibly valuable contribution here. I've often given an entire lecture on the subject of mediating structures because we tend to think government is public, individual is private. But this totally overlooks the whole range of mediating structures such as labor union, business organization, school, church, nonprofit, environmental group, and so on. All of these, in some ways, are public. They're open to people to participate in, to join, and so in a sense they do mediate between the formality of the state and the private life. But there has been this tendency to think of the government as public, the state as public, and everything else as private. But I think that probably is an oversimplification. The sociologist Peter Berger and Richard John Newhouse, the theologian, have written a little book, To Empower People, that discusses this at great length. The Catholic Church has the concept of subsidiarity and, again, of mediating structures. Great. This would have fit in very, very well as another lecture or another topic for the course. Yes, Daniel.
I was just thinking that you guys have been talking about ways to bring these religious worldviews into politics, but at the same time, American politics right now is more religious than it's been in a long time. You have a president who, you know, is clearly motivated in a big way by his religion, and yet at the same time, it seems like the ideas of caring and community and sustainability that we've been able to get out of our religious worldview are not what he's getting out of it. So I wonder
Tamara wanted to respond to that. Yeah, let me make another comment, Daniel. I actually think that some of what Bush is doing is far more productive in terms of improving the public life than the previous administration. I think I mentioned this in an earlier class. I was on a panel where someone was putting down Bush and saying he had no interest at all in improving the lot of the poor and so on and so on. And I said, wait a minute. He is addressing issues that are far more fundamental than anything that the previous president addressed. Namely, Bush is talking about strengthening families and marriage, and he's taking steps to implement that. Now, this is precisely the kind of discussion and debate I think we need in a vibrant society. I find it extraordinarily offensive at Cornell that almost the only comments you hear about President Bush is that he's an idiot or not very bright or he's imposing his religious views. Sorry, Daniel, I don't mean this against you. On other people, I think that's really quite outrageous in some ways because you could, in my view, make the judgment that by focusing on something as fundamental as the family and marriage, he might end up doing far more than the previous administration. But that's the kind of debate I'd love to see more of, because I think then it becomes productive. Daniel, and then Amiel?
I think that might be a good point, but I was talking more specifically about his environmental.
His environmental. Okay.
So I think that, you know, people in this country and around the world, whether they should or not, feel threatened by this kind of imperialist attitude that, you know, whether it's intended or not, seems to be coming through.
You mean imperialists like in Iraq and so on?
Yeah.
Okay. Amiel?
Yeah, this is sort of related, not specifically about Bush, but my question when I look at it is, what is the difference between the religious beliefs that you're talking about, using the Bible as an example for stewardship, as opposed to, you know, you say that there's so many people we have who are Christians or Judeo-Christians in this country, but the things that they're practicing are not in line with the things that you're saying are coming out of the religion itself.
Okay.
I mean, they basically say, okay, God
Okay.
Bush is another example of somebody who considers himself a devout Christian, but all of these things that you bring up as environmental ethics within Christianity are not necessarily being practiced by Christians. So whether or not it's a secular or non-secular discussion, maybe it's for, I'm personally not a religious person, but how is it that religious people who have environmental ethics are going to transfer that information to other practitioners?
Okay. And mind you, in light of that, I suggested in an earlier lecture that religion is often a very bad thing. Religion has been used to justify slavery, to justify the caste system, to justify perhaps neglect of environment, and so on. Religion is often a very bad thing. It's a complex world. There's very good data, for instance, that shows if you take university professors as a class, especially at our elite universities, they're far stingier in terms of what they give away than many of these sort of middle class, lower middle class Christians and other religious people. University professors as a class are very tight with their money. They are very good at telling other people how they ought to spend their money, what the government ought to do, but they don't do much with their own. So it's a complex issue. Religion can be a very bad thing. Secular belief can be a very bad thing. But isn't it good if we can get these issues out and talk about them and carry on a dialogue? Shannon, Greg, and then Edwina? Mm-hmm.
Politics, like, after the Monica Lewis speaking, you saw a lot of Bill Clinton going to church. Like, and depending on where they are, certain politicians are going to play that up more.
Okay.
The way it's being used is not a good way.
Okay. So it could be a public relations tool, you're suggesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay, Greg? Mm-hmm.
Biblical principles that can come out and give us maybe an adequate environmental ethics, but at the same time, you know, not all Christians believe that, or not all Christians act that way. And it is very much like them, yes. I imagine that's what it was like for those people who were fighting for the abolition of slavery and saw that there was no justification for it. And yet here on the other side were fellow Christians who were saying, oh, right here in the Bible, we've got to keep doing this. And I think it does bring us back to the Daniel's question, you know, how do you deal with this administration? You think about the Lynn White article that we visited briefly in this class that was addressing this Christian axiom of basically doing what we want with the environment. And I've come to decide, you know, that's old and tired, and oh my gosh, it was so insufficient and repeat in a lot of ways, and it's kind of old news, but it still is present news. If you look back, that article is actually addressing Ronald Reagan as governor of California because he made the comment that once we've seen one red flag, we've seen them all.
No.
Part of me thinks that the theological critique that White was making was almost more specifically aimed at that particular theology coming from a prominent, you know, governor leader who then became president and had a, you know, an interior secretary who they said things like that. That was a particular theological position that, you know, that's the point. It's sort of like that might be the argument point where previously it might have been something like slavery over the point of whether we're justified sort of biblically, if you will, in that slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question is, are we justified biblically in saying things like, ah, once you've seen one red flag, you've seen them all, you know, we need to just
keep
on doing what we're doing. And I think that this is, you know, that's the mix, that's a tension there. So we're sitting here trying to weigh whether it makes sense to keep going with this, but we might get someone like Bush who seems to sort of favor that kind of attitude. He seems to be in line with Reagan in some of those kind of development stances, and we just get bristled with our larger sense of not getting some of the more subtle passages of understanding, you know, the praise of all creation for God and
where we have sort of gone a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think that brings back to that question of, you know, it's not a question of having a more religious president, but sort of like the right religion, something like that. You know, and here we are. How do we deal with that? How do we, you know, how can you point at the president and say, well, we like his sort of Christian things with the family, but we don't like his Christian things with
okay.
non-Christian or supposedly Christian things with the
family. Okay. Which, good. Edwina, nice and loud, please.
Well, the thing I'm thinking is that, like, this is where the importance of bringing many different schools of thought into education is important. Because whenever someone, I mean, right now, religion is basically exposed to people who are uneducated. Whenever you, I mean, that's where you have the strongest following. People who just blindly follow everything that maybe the church leader tells them. And when you bring it into, when you bring religion and different schools of thought into education, then you have maybe more driven or smarter people pursuing the idea of religious thought and like different types of thinking that would then be better expressed in the politics as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Because most politicians you see today are well-educated people, but they've been educated in one school of thought. And also, I have one thing to say about the whole idea of the good life. Like, I think America has accepted a philosophy on what is the good life, and that is expressed in our economic and consumerist society today. I mean, that's what we are fueled by. Everyone, you know, in our society seems to think that the good life is spending money, making money, and having money.
Okay, in that sense, maybe, and I think that's a very helpful insight, probably the government is not nearly as neutral as political theorists would want. It actually does foster a vision of the good life, but it's mostly a vision of consumerism and economic growth that seems to be part of every administration. These are really, really... tough issues. Rick, and then Carl?
Yeah, I was going to say, along those lines, I was thinking that, for me, one of the biggest issues is that we're sort of in a conflict of interest position where our economy, the success of our economy, our ability to have jobs and make enough money to live, is dependent on people being convinced to buy things that they don't really need. And the way they're convinced is that through advertising, they're made to feel anxious about their health and various other aspects of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a subject of that, and I'm also a beneficiary of that at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So how can I... live in such a way that will help to do something good about that situation?
Okay, it takes a conscious effort almost because the forces are so strong in the other direction. Carl?
These last couple of comments about consumerism, I think, in some ways bring us back to where we started the whole conversation about the nature of education and what it ought to be and whether we ought to be specializing universities as knowledge production factories over against the pursuit of wisdom. And in some ways, point out is a very significant turning point in that history. Ezra Cornell was, of course, an industrial capitalist at a time when industrialism was having the effect of centralizing wealth among a very few, very wealthy people. And he and others like him, like Carnegie and Mellon and Rockefeller, they didn't just give their money away for somebody to start a university with it. And they had some very specific ideas of what they thought would make a good university. And in a sense, they created modern research universities in their own image that were very much part and parcel of the capitalist project of turning a profit. And they did not fund very many shares in moral philosophy. They funded primarily the pursuit of scientific research that was going to be serving some of the capital interests that they had. And so whereas
Thank you very much. I wish we had two or three more classes, Carl. I would snag you to lecture on that. That was extremely interesting. Wow. It's one of the great things about being a professor is you see your students mature and become wiser than you are and know more than you know. And it's a wonderful experience to see that happen. Carl's a PhD student of mine and did a master's degree, and it's wonderful to see that kind of growth. Maybe it does come back very, very much to the nature of the university and the nature of education. Rob, you're in a quite different field. Do you have any thoughts about any of this that you want to share? Or,
spoken a lot about Christianity and ethics and information, the environment of this class, and some people have offered to critique, well, Christians don't live in the ways that we discussed here. And I think it's not hard to make that argument, but if you look back to the slavery issue, William Lloyd Garrison, who was a firebrand fighter against slavery, was abhorred by the Boston churches who attacked the ministers endlessly for their support of the slavery issue. Question their true Christianity and how they can support that. And they almost lynched him in Illinois, and he lived a tough life. But he was a fighter. He gave a speech up in Seneca Falls, where the first speaker was a woman who talked about reconciliation between the various parties. And typical to Lloyd Garrison, he got up, he said, "I believe in sinners, and I believe in redemption."
Huh?
People are sinners, and they kind of finger pointed at them to attack them. So there's the point that whether it's the United States or the teachings of Christianity or the teachings of Hinduism, there's always a struggle over what will be the dominant way of interpreting that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I find in my own class, especially this year and growing each year, that bothers me immensely, I see it in this class, is the level of passivity, increasing passivity among the students each year. More and more quiet, more and more silent, more and more difficult to get them to engage in conversation. And I almost get the impression that a lot of you think that somehow you're going to be able to duck it, that you're going to walk out of here and somehow be able to duck some of these struggles. And you're not. You're going to, as it says in the Bible, you can't serve two masters. And you're going to, because you know I'm a real Bible plumber. But you're going to have to make some choices. And as it says in that great epic and theological film, The Mask of Zorro, you won't even have to go out and look for it because it will enter your circle soon enough. And you will not be able to avoid that fight. And the only way that you will triumph in that fight is if you think very deeply and very clearly about your ethics. Because that's the only place you'll be able to foundation yourself strong enough to engage with such a vast social question and make a contribution. So get off your duck. Get down there and fight.
Rob, thank you, because you are talking exactly like Solzhenitsyn has talked. He made almost that same speech at Harvard, and they hated him for it. They didn't want to hear that. That in some ways the Russians, the Soviets, had to struggle with these issues in a way that made them much deeper than the superficiality of the modern Western world. Thank you very much. Thank you all. Yeah. I'll clap for thank you.